welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, on our weekly roundtable, natural disasters quickly become humanitarian disasters, not due to acts of nature. Although there's no denying that the ferocity of the hurricanes we are seeing are due to climate change. How has the Trump administration responded to these disasters? Whose lives are valued over others? What is the Trump administration's bottom line? And what are the implications and impact of the NFL protests begun last year by Colin Kaepernick? Are people realizing that when it comes to race, racism, and white supremacy, there is nowhere to hide, not even at football games? Also, what can we glean from the election of an openly racist and bigoted Roy Moore in Alabama as the GOP candidate for Senate? He will face off against the Democratic candidate. And alongside his election, we see the rise of the extreme racist right in Germany, who for the first time since World War II are now in the German parliament, becoming the third largest party in the German government. Trump's tax plan. Is he lying yet again by calling it a tax plan that would benefit the middle class and not the wealthy? Our panelists are Mexico City-based Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Heavy rains and flash flooding are expected to compound the misery in Puerto Rico. The National Weather Service says the island will experience heavy rain through the weekend, which will aggravate ongoing Hurricane Maria recovery and relief efforts. The Trump administration has faced withering criticism for a lackluster response to the humanitarian crisis, with severe shortages of food, water, fuel, and medical care. In response, the military has sent a three-star general to direct hurricane response. Acting Homeland Security Director Elaine Duke defended the Trump administration's response.
I am very satisfied. I know it's a hard storm to recover from, but the amount of progress that's been made, and I really would appreciate any support that we get. I know it is really a good news story in terms of our ability to reach people and the limited number of deaths that have taken place in such a devastating hurricane.
That description sparked an angry response by the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz, who spoke to CNN.
Maybe from where she's standing, it's a good news story. When you're drinking from a creek, it's not a good news story. When you don't have food for a baby, it's not a good news story. When you have to pull people down from their buildings, because, you know, that, I'm sorry, but that really upsets me and frustrates me. You know, I would ask her to come down here and visit the towns. And then make a statement like that, which frankly, it is an irresponsible statement. This is not a good news story.
New York Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez, a native of Puerto Rico, joined with other Democrats in calling for a speedy logistical response and for legislation like the financial aid packages approved by Congress in the aftermath of hurricanes Irma and Harvey. Federal officials announced they arrested nearly 500 undocumented immigrants in a four-day nationwide sweep targeting sanctuary cities with policies that limit cooperation with federal immigration agents. California was the top target, with Immigration and Customs Enforcement reporting 194 arrests, 167 in and around Los Angeles, and the remainder in San Francisco and Santa Clara counties. ICE reported 107 arrests in Philadelphia, 63 in Denver, 45 in New York, 30 in the Chicago area, 28 in Baltimore, 14 in Washington, D.C. ICE Acting Director Tom Homan explained the targeted roundup in a statement saying sanctuary cities that don't honor detainers or allow access to jails and prisons are shielding what he called criminal aliens and creating a magnet for illegal immigration, home added, as a result, ICE is forced to dedicate more resources to conduct at-large arrests in these communities. A senior attorney with Public Counsel told the Los Angeles Times the raids were clearly a political move and not actually geared toward public safety. The arrest came as Governor Jerry Brown is soon expected to sign legislation effectively making California a sanctuary state, limiting the cooperation of local law enforcement with federal immigration authorities. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged the world body to take strong action in the face of Myanmar government attacks on the country's Rohingya minority. Guterres noted the attacks have spurred a fast-moving exodus of refugees into neighboring Bangladesh.
The situation has spiraled into the world's fastest developing refugee emergency and a humanitarian and human rights nightmare. At least 500,000 civilians have fled their homes and sought safety in Bangladesh. We have received bone-chilling accounts from those who fled, mainly women, children, and the elderly.
Myanmar's ethnic Rohingya minority are Muslim in a predominantly Buddhist nation. Despite living in Myanmar for generations, the government does not recognize the Rohingya as citizens, claiming they are immigrants from neighboring Bangladesh. The top 10% of the population now owns 77% of the nation's wealth. That's according to a new analysis by the People's Policy Project. The findings are based on newly released Federal Reserve data. They also show the bottom 38% of U.S. families have an average net worth of $0, and those in the bottom 10% are net debtors, owing 0.5% of the nation's wealth. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont responded to the report on Twitter, quote, "Meanwhile, the Walton family of Walmart has a net worth of $144 billion. This is what a rigged economy looks like," Sanders said. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and I'd like to welcome our panelists, Mexico City-based Laura Carlson, political analyst and writer. She's written extensively on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues in a number of media outlets. She's also a columnist for The Huffington Post, Foreign Policy in Focus, and others. She has appeared on NPR, Al Jazeera, BBC, Mexican television and radio stations. She has participated as an analyst and activist in the movement against militarization and the drug war on both sides of the border. She is the host of the Mexican television program Huecho en America. Laura, welcome.
Thanks, Margaret. Glad to be here.
And Laura, we are too. We were so worried about you and your family after the devastating earthquake in the area where you live. So we're glad that you and your family are well and able to join us today. And I'd also like to welcome Jackie Goldberg. She has served in the California State Assembly and on the Los Angeles City Council and also on the Los Angeles School Board. She also served as president of the school board. She's currently on contract with the mayor's office to help with a plan called Service and Workforce Restoration. She's been an educator all of her life. Jackie Goldberg, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Gerald Horn, the Moores Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including most recently Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Ropes and the Artists as Revolutionary. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
We are going to go right into, there's so much going on. Sometimes one doesn't really know where to start, but we'll start with these seeming natural disasters. They are natural disasters, but also discuss it a bit within the context of how they can quickly turn and have turned in some instances into massive humanitarian disasters. Laura Carlson, let's start with you because we're going to be talking about the hurricanes, but what you all have been dealing with in Mexico, three different earthquakes, right? One was said to be an aftershock to the first quake that took place near the Chiapas region, but it was a 7.1. So as far as I'm concerned, that's just another major earthquake. And then, of course, the major one that hit Mexico City. Tell us where things are with that one, about the loss of life, but also about the efforts on the ground that people are taking to avoid this becoming a massive humanitarian disaster. Laura Carlson.
That's right. There are two parallel scenes here, because the death toll is rising as they begin to pull more bodies out of the rubble. I was just at a site that's very close to my house here where a building collapsed yesterday, and they're still pulling people out. The hope of pulling out survivors has dimmed, as you can imagine, at more than a week after the major earthquake of September 19th. But they are still pulling out bodies, and there's still quite a few people who are reported as missing. So eventually we're hoping that they'll be recovered one way or another, so at least the families can know what happened to their loved ones. That's the tragic side of it, and it's more than that as well, because there's so many people who are without housing and basic needs. There are people who lost absolutely everything in the earthquake when these buildings collapsed. There are about 50 buildings, between 40 and 50 buildings that completely collapsed in Mexico City, and there are some 500 that are slated to be demolished because they're so badly damaged you can't even go in there safely to recover belongings. So that's a lot of people that are homeless. And then on the other hand, you have the story, and then of course that's not counting the states of Morelos and Puebla, where there's significant damage from the September 19th earthquake, and the states of Chiapas and Oaxaca that were significantly damaged by both the first one on September 7th and then the second one, which was said to be from the same fault. Now, what's happening on the ground, though, is fascinating. It's something that we saw in 1985. Everyone probably has heard that September 19th was exactly when the earthquake in 1985 happened, in which some 5,000 to 10,000 people were killed. We don't even have the number on that. So it was hugely ironic that it was the exact same day that this one struck, and we're seeing a very, very similar civic response, where especially young people from the universities are going out, forming their own brigades, helping with the rescue missions. They're forming brigades. I was just at the Department of Psychology at the National University yesterday. They're taking special classes and going out for psychological support for victims and family members. They're doing all kinds of tasks that have to do with taking care of donations and getting them to where they need to be. And we haven't seen this kind of civic participation, this kind of sense of a collective and of social responsibility for a very, very long time. It's transforming the lives of the people who are getting involved. And the level of compassion, just out in the street, strangers will hug you and say, "How are you?" You know, is something that you don't really see in an advanced capitalist society. And so it's breaking a lot of the barriers that existed in a major city between people and changing the political culture.
Yeah, and the history of the, you know, going back in a way to the indigenous roots of collective action, right, seems to be breaking out all over there. But Laura, I also wanted you to quickly comment just in terms of the Trump administration. First of all, it took some time before Trump even contacted the government in Mexico to, you know, express condolences or any such thing. And then just yesterday, the administration, Jeff Sessions, Department of Justice, did a huge sweep across the country targeting sanctuary cities that are sanctuary for immigrants, specifically to let people know there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. And it just seemed particularly bruising with the threat of people being returned to a Mexico that is, in some instances, not all undocumented people pick picked up, of course, are from Mexico, but we know that there's that is the majority, to a devastated Mexico, a Mexico that is grieving. It just seemed unconscionable. Laura,
that's
just a reaction.
Good point, Margaret. Yeah, they're throwing people back, and in many cases, people who don't even really know the country, into a nation that's in crisis, that will be struggling to even get itself back on its feet in a number of areas, not just Mexico City, but in the south from the other earthquakes as well. And we're, of course, a hurricane risk, and there have been a number of tropical storms that have affected the country during this time, too. So it's extremely insensitive. And at the same time, there have been no commitments of rebuilding aid to Mexico. The Trump administration took 5 days to say anything at all when Donald Trump finally said, well, I called him. I couldn't get through on his cell phone for 5 days.
Oh, please.
You know, to a president. Anyone could get through. But on the first earthquake, and then later tried to rectify it with a message of concern, and they sent down a small rescue team. But there's the real challenge is going to be in the long term. What do you do in terms of rebuilding all these this housing that's needed? There's a huge expense. And it's not a nation with over half the population living in poverty already that has money to confront that kind of a crisis without many, many more people dropping into poverty and many more people living in extremely precarious and vulnerable conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jackie Goldberg, having you weigh in on this now, luckily, we're getting increasing news about the massive humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico and the lack of action, the delayed reaction. I don't even know what to call it of Trump's, the administration reaction to the massive hurricane that has devastated Puerto Rico. Of course, Puerto Rico, U.S. citizens, but also the U.S. territories of the U.S. Virgin Islands. We're hearing nothing about St. Croix that was so hard hit by Hurricane Maria as well. And I just wanted you to just weigh in on your thoughts on all of this, because it seems to me as though Puerto Rico, but also all of those islands that were hit, the U.S., and I do want to name them because people are not naming them. You have Puerto Rico, Antigua and Barbuda, Anguilla, St. Bartholomew, St. Martin, the British Virgin Islands, Cuba, Turks and Caicos Islands, the Dominican Republic, Guadeloupe, Dominica devastated, right? And this, to me, points to what we have discussed before on the roundtable about a double standard on whose lives are valued, who are worth saving, you know, who are not, where resources go, where resources don't go. It's just unconscionable. Jackie Goldberg.
Well, I think we saw it first in Katrina.
Yeah,
you know, because it was a city of unimportance to Bush, and they couldn't get it together to do anything that was necessary for a very long time, and that was in the continental United States. So being further away, and you know, there are huge numbers of people who don't even know that Puerto Ricans are American citizens. So there is a lot of ignorance about all of this in the general public, and that makes it much easier for Trump to ignore it and to send people who say, oh, things are going really well there. We've sent all this food. Well, you know, you can watch every night in the nightly news and see that the food's sitting on the docks in containers because they don't have the infrastructure. The roads aren't clear. The army is there with about 7,000 troops, but when they had a problem with Katrina, they sent in 20,000 troops, although belatedly late, but still they sent a lot more people in to help when that city was under siege, finally. So I think what we're really seeing is that, you know, I mean, I remember when we first heard about what was going on in Houston on the same time that there was a major earthquake in Oaxaca in the south of Mexico that got almost no coverage anywhere. It was like I saw it one day in the L.A. Times. Oh, yeah, big earthquake in southern Mexico. So I think there's a lot of notion on the part of Trump and others that only some people matter a real lot, and then other people we'll get to when we have time. And if we can get to them when we have time, it'll be okay. I mean, the fact that there is no running water and electricity, and no electricity in most of Puerto Rico, and no running water in more than half of the state, the Commonwealth, rather. It's just unbelievable. This is 8-9 days later. You need to be able to begin doing that. People dying in Puerto Rico from lack of diesel, keeping the pumps going so that their required maintenance of life by machines and so forth, helping them breathe and so forth. People are actually dying there. Hospitals are closed. Lights are not on. I mean, it's really a catastrophe. And, of course, you know, I think at some point we need to be talking again and again and again about how all of this is related to sea level rise and storm surge and more hurricanes, more drought, and wildfires. We're talking about global warming being seen up close and personal, and not having a government that is able to react or willing to react positively to deal with the suffering, much less not being willing to deal with the cause.
Right. denying the cause. You're absolutely right. But Jackie Goldberg, in the presentations, I've listened to some of them from the Caribbean region to the UN General Assembly. I mean, they all start with saying we can no longer deny global warming, that the devastation we are facing is as a result of global warming. And so, Dr. Gerald Horn, here, the part of the presentation from the island nation of St. Kitts and Nevis. They said to the UN that the carnage in a wide swath of the Caribbean is unimaginable. Lives have been lost, homes and infrastructure destroyed, economies reduced to tatters, years of development wiped out, and in the case of Barbuda, an entire island evacuated and rendered uninhabited and uninhabitable for the first time in 300 years. I mean, that is just stunning, Dr. Horn. And I had a discussion with somebody from the region, from Barbuda, Antigua, yesterday on the show, and we were making the connection about the horror of the reaction of the World Bank and these multinational institutions. This is talking about non-U.S. territories now, about refusing some level of aid to these islands on the basis, well, you know, they could be considered middle class, you know, which is really a joke, right? Anybody from the region knowing that, but also the burden of this massive so-called third world debt, the debt that these World Bank and IMF have been extracting from these places, including, by the way, Puerto Rico, and the relationship of that to the humanitarian disaster and how people are going to manage to survive in the face of everything being destroyed. Dr. Horn.
Well, just as we speak correctly of how climate change has intensified and worsened these hurricanes and storms, we should also speak of how colonialism and neocolonialism and imperialism have intensified and worsened the effects of the storms. You see this in particular with the case of Puerto Rico, a U.S. colony where U.S. nationals ostensibly do not have a say in choosing the U.S. president. Then you have the so-called Jones Act, which limits the ability of non-U.S. ships with non-U.S. crews to deliver aid to the island at a time when Washington is obviously asleep at the switch. You saw a similar impact of colonialism with regard to Guam just a few weeks ago, when supposedly it was in the crosshairs of North Korean missiles simply because it was a so-called U.S. territory. Then there is the question of racism. That is to say that Puerto Ricans are generally people of color. Likewise, the people of the Virgin Islands, who are overwhelmingly of African descent. And I don't think it's accidental that Mr. Trump has been paying much more attention to the National Football League and who's kneeling at football games than to the nationals of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, because the nationals of Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands are basically black and brown people. I should also say that the lackadaisical attitude of Washington rings rather oddly at a time when cabinet members like Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Price are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on private jets. You would think that at least he would take one of his private jets to Puerto Rico or the Virgin Islands to inspect the healthcare system. Entire hospitals have been destroyed, for example, in the Virgin Islands. The only possible upside that I can see with regard to this fiasco is that you may have more folk from Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands moving to Florida, where they'll be able to cast ballots, presumably for the presidency, and therefore can help to oust Mr. Trump from office in 2020, if not before.
Yeah, and Dr. Horn, on the whole issue of reparations in the region, because as much of the horror that we see on Puerto Rico, and well, we're not hearing much about St. Croix, which is part of the U.S. Virgin Islands, but those islands that are independent, like Dominica, that have been completely destroyed, we're not hearing anything about them at all. And these are populations of people brought to the Caribbean region, enslaved, right, have established their independence. And at the ending of slavery in the region, the slave owners were paid reparations for the loss of their slave labor, and of course, no such thing happened as a result. But now you have these regions really needing the aid and should have it, not as beggars at the gates, but these are islands that help to create huge wealth and the rise of capitalism in both the United States as well as the UK. And now they are basically left to flounder. So, Dr. Horn, it does seem to me as though the whole issue of reparations within this context of what rights people should have and what resources they have earned should be part of the discussion. Just a comment from you on that before we go to station.
Well, you are correct. The founding father of modern Trinidad and Tobago, Eric Wiggins, in his epical book, Capitalism and Slavery, basically detailed the case that you just made in terms of enslavement of Africans being the foundation of capitalism. And I think that this current catastrophe in that region should lead to a major political shift, that is to say, aligning with the BRICS, aligning with China and Russia in particular, and having a full court press on the North Atlantic nations with regard to reparations for centuries of unpaid labor.
Right. Well, on that note, let's see if we can take a short station break right now. And when we continue our discussion, we'll go on to the NFL, Trump's tax plan, and more with our weekly roundtable. Don't touch the dial. Stay with us. We'll be right back. That beautiful song, like a prayer, really, is Earth Mother. The artist is Robert Tree. Cody, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And that song reminds us, it almost feels as though Mother Earth is crying out, sending us a message with all of the global warming, the earthquakes, the hurricanes, volcanic eruptions. And now in Hawaii, we see a major fight happening where scientists are bent on placing a telescope on a mountain that is considered sacred to indigenous people of Hawaii. One wonders, when are we going to learn? This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And I encourage you to subscribe for a free podcast where you can listen to the show anytime, anywhere you are in the city, the nation, or indeed the world. We're also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in indigenous lands everywhere in the Americas. And you can check us out and get our back shows also on our website. Just go to www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, please spread the word, like and friend us on Facebook, on both the website and Facebook. There's a lot of news, a lot that we cover there, photos and more that we're not able to get to when we are live on the air. This is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. Now, on Sunday, September 24th, historic day for the National Football League, where a few hundred players, coaches from football teams across the league silently protested during the U.S. national anthem. Despite all of what people have said since then, trying to switch the conversation to one of patriotism, it was a show of solidarity for Colin Kaepernick and others who have done the same in the name of Black lives, the name of police brutality, and the deaths of Black people, and no one being held to account, police officer after police officer being let go. And then, of course, Trump calling them sons of bitches, which was, of course, insulting not only to the players and not ignoring the reason for the protest, but also to the mothers of the players and the mothers of the league. They have an organization. They issued a statement taking exception to Trump's comments and saying that they support the right of their sons to protest, and also the cause, reminding us of the underlying cause more than this kind of vague unity that the debate in the mainstream media seem to be going on this. Laura Carlson, let's go to you, because, you know, I happen to think that there's really nothing that goes on in these United States that, you know, isn't with a, you know, the lens of race isn't too far below, if not right there, front and center, not only in terms of policy and relationships among us in the United States, but also international policy. Some of that reflected in how Mexico was neglected by Trump, how Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands neglected by Trump. But I just wanted to get your take on the significance of this NFL protest, and also the attempt to shift the conversation away from the original protest against racism and police brutality into some vague patriotism and standing for veterans. Laura Carlson.
It's interesting seeing from afar, because at first, after with all the press that's been generated, there's a suspicion that this is, again, another diversionary tactic, that there are other issues that are important that are getting swept into the sidelines by so much tension on the NFL protest. And yet the framework that you suggest, that everything is, in fact, tainted or affected by the deep racism that exists in the country, and that that's now become a mainstream part of the politics and people take positions on it, is very important. In other words, the NFL protest has a great deal of significance even for foreign policy and in helping us to understand what's happening, not just in the United States in internal politics, but within the world. As because of immigration and the rise of the nationalist and white supremacist right in many parts of the world, this is becoming a major issue that nations have to deal with, and you find more people taking a stance on. To lead it toward a debate on patriotism, that's really a diversionary tactic. You know, I think that's where people are trying not to have to face up to the fact that this is a reality that, of course, anyone is justified. I think also the other thing that was particularly heartening about these gestures, about these very public demonstrations, is that they inhibit any kind of normalization of a Trump government in which white supremacy is, and those kinds of views are justified, or normalization of racism and police brutality in our communities. And any time you can do that in a nonviolent way, I think is extremely important.
Right. And Jackie Goldberg, I mean, on the one hand, we know why Trump is on television while all this pressure is on him in relation to perhaps illegality going on in the White House, even within his perhaps him, Trump himself, North Korea, the humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico, et cetera, that he chooses that time to throw some red meat out of the blue, right, to some red meat in a speech in Alabama to his base. And it really, to me, shows that Trump really understands how race has historically been used, and racism has, and white supremacy in this country, really as almost like a mask to hide how all of us are getting screwed, you know, starting, of course, with black and brown people, but also in particular, white working class people. You know, it used to be like, well, you know, you may be poor and living in a trailer, but at least you're not black, or at least you're not an immigrant. Right. So there's that on the one hand. And on the other hand, we also can't ignore the significance of these major NFL players. And when I see them, they speak very eloquently about the reason for their protests. Jackie Goldberg.
Well, I think their protests started with the idea of Black Lives Matter and the notion that they're continuously disturbed by the shooting of African American men to death by police and with little or no consequences for doing so. So that's where it starts. When Trump comes in, what he does is he changes it from, in some cases, a Black Lives Matter and to a more anti-Trump kind of response. And I think that's what the press has done. They've taken out the real reason for the protest and made it about Trump again, which is what is so wrong with everything that happens in this country. Everything is about Trump. No, it isn't. It's about what they're doing, not what they're saying. And we need to be covering what they're doing a lot more than what they're saying.
Yeah. And
but I think we need to understand that there is a misunderstanding about who Trump won with. People, a lot of pundits say he won with this white working class business. But really, actually, he won with everybody who was white. The median income of Trump supporters was $72,000.
Wow.
$72,000. That's not the white working class, ladies and gentlemen. He won whites making less than $50,000 by 20 points. He made whites making $50,000 to $100,000, he won by 28 points. And he won with whites making $100,000 or more by 14 points. This is hardly, the disgruntled white working class. What's really happening around the world, in Europe and in the United States and where there are white people, is the realization, the coming realization, that the white dominance of the last several centuries is coming closer and closer to an end. And when that happens, you get a reaction not only from people who are bigots and racists and supremacists, but just from people who say, what's happening? I don't recognize my country. And that's a racist response, but it is not based in that underlying bigotry. It's based in not understanding how things are changing in the world so quickly. And this is a problem that the left has failed to address. It has failed to address the cultural issues that people are dealing with when they see change that they don't understand and that nobody is making any real effort to explain to them. So we have a left that is not doing its job, in my opinion, in Europe and in the United States, although with one exception, with that wonderful man in the Labour Party in England is doing some of it. So what you're having is where did Trump do the best? He did the best in those parts of the country where there were virtually no people of color living, in those areas that were isolated white areas, where the understanding of what racism means is really at a great distance, and it's easy to convince them that they have been overlooked because, you know what, a lot of people aren't talking about them. And I think what we're seeing around in Germany, you know, 95% of the Germans who voted for that sort of neo-Nazi party said that they were worried about losing their identity and their language, their culture and their language. That's a part of this that is a different type of racism than people who are just simply bigots and who don't want anything to do with Jews or blacks or Muslims. And I think we need to address both kinds of white supremacy and both types of racism, and we're really not. And I think that's a big part of the problem of why these right-wing parties in the United States, being the Republican Party of Alabama, getting rid of a right-winger for an even further right-winger, a guy who is clearly uninterested in supporting justice in the United States or following the rule of law. We're seeing a reaction that is based on different types of racism, and not all of it is being addressed, and it has to be if we're going to help people move, white people move beyond it.
Yeah, well said. And Dr. Gerald Horn, your comments on this. I know you've been talking about this quite a bit, but also connected also to what happened this election in Alabama, that happened, what I call the strange election that elected this Moore to be the GOP candidate in Alabama, because that's really just a continuation of all this, Dr. Horn.
Well, first of all, with regard to the protests by the athletes, there's a long history of this. Most people think of Muhammad Ali, the boxer, and his protests against the Vietnam War, the protests at the 1968 Olympics by Tommy Smith and John Carlos in Mexico City. But it actually goes back to the beginning of the century with the black heavyweight boxer Jack Johnson, who outraged white supremacists by knocking out white men one after another, leading to the search for so-called Great White Hope, leading to his conviction on trumped-up charges and his fleeing to Mexico, where he aligned with revolutionary Mexico during the decade from 1910 to 1920 and tried to set up a base of opposition to U.S. Jim Crow in Mexico before a regime change caused him to come back to the United States and be jailed. I think we should also realize that these protesters are also engaged in enlightened self-interest. That is to say that just because you're black and drive a Mercedes and a BMW, that does not mean you will not be touched by the police. In fact, there's probably more of a likelihood that you will be touched, particularly if you look at the history of lynching, where disproportionately and overwhelmingly affluent Negro men were lynched, more so than poor Negro men were lynched, disproportionately. I think that these protests also raises the contradictions within the United States itself. That is to say, founded, in my opinion, as a revolt against abolitionism in London, founded as a revolt against the abolition of slavery, with the third stanza of the national anthem actually attacking black people specifically. It's rather rare for a national anthem to attack a portion of the citizenry. I think also that with regard to this outrageous election in Alabama, sending Roy Moore, presumably, to the U.S. Senate, an 11th century Christian crusader, this is also a reflection of global trends insofar as what's happened over the past few decades is an attack on unions, an attack on working class solidarity, which has created a vacuum that's now being filled by religious zealotry and ethnic solidarity. You saw that, as you've just suggested, in the election in Germany with the Alternative for Germany party, so-called, getting about 14% of the vote, a neo-Nazi party, a German chauvinist party. And you see this now in Alabama. And things seemingly may be taking a turn for the worse, believe it or not, because the Supreme Court has just taken a case which bids fair to weaken unions even further in the United States, particularly government sector unions like the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, which is a party in this case. And so obviously it suggests that we have a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. And Laura Carlson, you know, it would be interesting to see how people are seeing what happened in Alabama. I mean, some of the things that this Roy Moore has said, he called Native Americans and Asian Americans reds and yellows. He doesn't believe in evolution. He waved a pistol while giving a speech at a campaign rally in Alabama. It said that he rode in on a horse, right? And, you know, he creates hysteria by saying people in the U.S. are being overtaken by Sharia law repeal. I mean, the list can just go on and on and on and on. But just looking at that election and also, as Dr. Horn referred to, and Jackie, and what happened in Germany with this alternative for Germany party. And looking at what is going on in the region, in Latin America right now, because we know that we had that spate of left-leaning governments led, first of all, by Venezuela for a while. And then you see increasingly, with U.S. support, those governments either being undermined or failing in elections and thus and so, and we know that elections are going to be coming up also in Mexico. What is your take on this? I mean, are you seeing like a similar kind of rise in the right in the region where you are, or it really remains to be seen? Laura Carlson.
Yes, there has been a rise in the right, and we see that especially in Argentina and in Brazil, and that really affects the geopolitics of the entire region. And then when we look to Alabama and to Germany, again, we see it's not just a rise in the right, but it's a rise in the crackpot right, which in some ways even the Republican Party had been trying to control over all these years, because it has a tendency eventually to fall from its own errors and crackpotness, or whatever the word is. I mean, this is a person, you gave a long list of Judge Roy Moore's controversial, to say the least, positions, but also, you know, we're talking about someone who actually said publicly that 9/11 was God's punishment for allowing, quote, abortion and sodomy. And so the attack that's there against half the human race, women, and also particularly against gay people, and just almost, you know, a whole long list of people that are at risk from the rise of these kinds of politics, and of course in Germany as well with what's almost a neo-Nazi party, is very long. And here I think it's interesting to bring back what Jackie said, that you've got a combination of people, like it's been said that this is a win in Alabama for the Bannon faction, and there's a part there of the right that has a very clear plan to restore white dominance and prevent the demographics from threatening that by either almost, you know, complete disenfranchisement and a whole range of different kinds of strategies, some of which almost approach genocidal proportions. And then you have the people who are really very ignorant. And again, Trump also won in parts of the country where there's almost no immigrants, on an anti-immigrant message. So it's really ignorance that's voting there rather than a coherent strategy to restore white dominance. And it's a combination of ignorance and insecurity. And we do, as the left, have to take that into account. It doesn't mean that we at all justify racist behaviors, whether they're from ignorance or from a very conscious strategy. But it does mean that we approach them differently by providing scenarios in which you can say, look, you can have a better life at the same time as living harmonically with other races and with other types of people, and the real enemy is this inequality that has grown so much throughout the world, and that's what we have to fight against. But we haven't constructed that narrative sufficiently in order to be able to fight back against these offensives that are winning in so many parts of the world of the right, and that are also winning among the youth, which is something we really have to take into account.
Right. And Jackie Goldberg, I'm looking at the clock here, your comments on this. But also, we didn't have a lot of time for the tax plan. We did discuss it on the show somewhat yesterday. So we encourage people to go to yesterday's show on that. But the New York Times is reporting that Trump could save more than $1 billion under his new tax plan. And, you know, this is another lie. The so-named big middle class tax cut, and it is connected to what we have been discussing in the ways of keeping people divided. Jackie Goldberg, I'm afraid you'll have the last word on this.
Well, the Trump plan is definitely a big help to people who are rich, super rich, the one-tenth of 1%, because they're the only people now who are still paying estate taxes, for example, and they're going to get rid of that. That's really literally just thousands of people. It's not a huge number of people because it's already been reduced to the point where you can, you know, pass on billions of dollars to your family without paying any taxes at all. In addition to which, they're getting rid of the alternate minimum tax. That's the one that took Trump from about 5 million to about 36 million that he had to pay in taxes, and the one we got, which was the 2005 tax information on him. So he's getting rid of that. He also, you know, and who are the most likely beneficiaries of getting rid of the estate tax, what's left of it, is his children. His children will be hugely benefited by this. So this notion that somehow or another the wealthy are not being done, this is really aimed at middle class, well, it's sort of the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away, because while they are increasing the amount of money that you get as a standard deduction, they're removing your personal deduction. So, for example, if you're a upper middle class family, let's say you're making $180,000 to $100,000 a year and you've got three children, you will pay more taxes than you're paying now, because you'll get a $24,000 change improvement on one end, but you'll lose the amount of money that you were getting for each dependent on the other end. So what we're really seeing is that we have a tax plan that is aimed at providing his big donors with the kind of tax relief they've asked for, while they've given up on debt reduction. There's no deficit reduction at all. In fact, there's a huge amount that will be added to the deficit. And here's the important thing, the difference between Bush and Reagan when they did their tax cuts. We were in recession. We are now in an expanding economy. And in those days when they did their tax cuts, you had the opportunity for the economy to expand and perhaps make up some of the loss of the deficit. There's no chance of that. This notion of scoring this as neutral, because it will create so much more investment in business and something. When the tax cuts happened the last time, what happened was they bought their own stock back, and they paid off the people who own stock in their companies with big dividends. They did not invest it in more company research and development. They did not invest it in raising the wages of their workers. They did none of that. And so this is really a lie. This is the biggest lie of the big lies that he's told so far.
Right. And we are out of time. Another fascinating roundtable. I'd like to thank each and every one of our panelists. Today's show produced by myself, Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers, and, of course, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, and Kiana Williams, our engineer for today. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to Pacifica Radio Archives. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.